You're listening to Seminary Dropout, and I'm your host, Shane Blackshear. In cooperation with MissioAlliance.org, straight from my house in Austin, Texas to yours, interviews with leading Christian authors, leaders, and thinkers, because good theology should be for everyone. This is Seminary Dropout. Let's go! My guest, Joe Saxton, is a popular leadership trainer, international speaker, and author who's passionate about seeing Jesus transform lives across the globe. She's been featured at IF Gathering, Catalyst, Thrive, and Propel conferences. Joe also chairs the board of an international discipleship organization known as 3D Movements, serves on the advisory board for Today's Christian Woman, and co-hosts the Lead Stories podcast. Joe and her husband, Chris, live in the Minneapolis area with their three daughters. Joe, thanks for being back.
Thank you for having me.
I don't know if I mentioned your new book. I should have been in that bio. I'm sorry. Your new book is called Dream of You. I have to tell you, something went very wrong because I got an advance copy and there were no Wonder Woman socks or
anything in there.
Just a kink to work out at some point.
Yeah, I will make sure that... Would you like some Wonder Woman socks? Because that can be arranged.
So my daughter is, I've got a 4-year-old and we're big on Wonder Woman.
Good.
Yeah. So I've got enough paraphernalia, but you know, you could always use more. So Dream of You is, you know, essentially about kind of letting go of false identities, either that people have put on us or we've put on ourselves to discover a more authentic, fulfilling self that God actually gave us. And I wonder for you, what were some of the first signs that those images that you're trying to live up to weren't really working out for you?
I think some of it was the image. Probably in my childhood, I think it became very apparent that the perception of my worth and value felt particularly pressured and didn't feel consistent. You know, so. I think I would say the key, I'd probably be around 7. Now, there are lots of circumstances which made me think, well, that was whack and that was weird. But I think the moment when I thought this isn't going to work, 7 years old, in the 80s in London, Nigerian background. I'm Nigerian background, but I'm born in London. And in the early 80s, there were a number of riots in an area called Brixton and other parts of town as well. And you know, we're, I don't know, 30, 40 years from that time now. So you can look back far clearly about all the things that were going on. But even then, they acknowledged lots of poverty, systemic discrimination in relation to race in particular, conflicts with the police, things like that. And I remember watching the news and not fully understanding all that I was seeing, because it was also the part of town we used to go to every Saturday and buy food. And I didn't recognize the descriptions of the people the news would suggest, you know, about this community and this devastated people. And I'm like, oh, is that us? And my aunt, around that time, and I can't remember the exact event, so I just remember the haze of that period of time, and my aunt saying to me, hey, Joe, it's not, you need to understand a few things, that life isn't fair. And there are a number of things marked against you. One, you're a woman. Secondly, you're a black woman. And as a result, you won't be able to do what your friends do. You won't get away with what your friends get away with. You're going to need to be at least twice as good. And I remember her saying, at least. Because that's what you'll need to be able to make it in this country. And my aunt and my mom and many others of our family had moved to England in the 60s. And so had encountered all kinds of challenges just trying to make a life for their families. And so I think at that point was the first time I thought it was more, that was a more conscious, there were other things, but that's where I was more conscious of something being imposed on me, like a stereotype of what my limitations were, of who I was and my worth and value.
I was listening in preparation for this, the first time that you came on the show, and we talked a little bit about that. And it seems like, I've got another podcast called On Ramp, which is about race through the lens of Christianity. I have a co-host who's biracial. And one of the things that we were talking about was, how, I think often white people will see people of color, functioning very well in a very white space.
Yeah.
And we'll get the idea, we being white people, we'll get the idea, wow, that's really natural. And it looks like
they don't even think about the fact that they're predominant culture that's not their own. And then, but I've found that when I have conversations with my friends of color and you dig a little bit deeper, you find out that they're acutely aware.
Oh, yeah.
That they're different in a space that's very white.
Absolutely. And aware of every decision that you have to make. And you're so used to them. By the time I'm an adult, I've been doing this since I was like 5, 6, 7 years old. So it's not, it's instinctive. And I mean, it had added another nuance when I moved to the US as well.
Yeah.
But even throughout my childhood and my teens and my young adulthood, I was very, I mean, you're always aware. Shonda Rhimes in The Year of Yes puts it as being the first only different, in her environments as a showrunner. And I loved her terminology because it gave language to some of the environments I was in, but also that I wouldn't be that, not just that I was the first only different, but for other people, I was their first, I was their only,
and I
was their different. And what that does for your everyday things like dating, and what it does for your everyday things like how you perceive work and hope and ambitions and dreams and living in life with people and faith, it's huge, huge. Oh yeah, it's like your mind never stops.
Yeah. So I'm so glad you brought that up. Okay. So, you know, you've been on this podcast once before and you do a lot of podcasts, so there's no reason you should like remember me or anything like that. But let me say, I follow everything you do and I love everything you have to say. And I will see online somewhere an advertisement for a Christian conference or something. And among the keynote speakers, it's like 12 white people and Joe Saxton.
Yeah.
You noticed that.
Yeah.
And I think, well, I'm glad Joe's there. But it seems to obviously be tokenism, but it's like you have a limited power about what you can do about that. I mean, I guess you could not show up, but I think that's not the best solution. But I wonder if you feel a responsibility to kind of, I don't know, one, represent people who aren't just white affluent people in that space, or, and also to maybe like, you know, gently push back against those who invited you to maybe include more people in the future.
Yeah, there are a number of things. I mean, there are a lot more no's than there are yeses. I'll say that.
What do you mean by that?
There are a lot more events I'll say no to.
Oh, sure. Yeah, yeah.
I'd say there are a number of places. Some have felt like tokenism. Some have felt like, and some places are very candid and say, honestly, we are behind on this. We are behind on how to engage with different leaders of color. We're behind, and this is our starting point. Because they'll have seen me at something else before. I think sometimes I'm probably an easier option.
How?
I think in some ways I'm not entirely sure how. I'm not often the only one when the topic is on race. I often refuse to do the ones on race in the US. Partly because I'm like, this will not be the most enriching experience for your community. If you're wanting to know the stories of the African American community, I'm going to recommend about 25,000 African Americans you should be talking with. If you want to understand the nuances and the journey of the Latina community, then it's not hard. Do you know what I mean? Same again, Asian American community. I said, I come as an African immigrant, and I come as an African immigrant who's a Brit. And so if we were talking in England, there's all kinds of things I'd tell you about it, what it was for us systemically, but I'm still learning here. And also I come as a black Brit with an English accent, and I get discounts in stores just for the way I sound. So, which I mean, glory to God, I like the discounts, but I don't know. But for what, when an event is developing a vision for what they want, then when it's on topics of race, I often encourage them to think way broadly than me. I think in some instances as well, it's rare now that I'm the only person. Sometimes I'm the only person when it's a women's conference or whatever, and then I'll be their keynote, which is actually a different nuance to being the only one of 10 or 12. I think in some instances, it's funny. I remember someone asking me, you know, do you feel like the token? And I'm like, I might be your token, but I ain't. I'm not a token, no. How can I put it? I had this conversation with someone years ago, and I said, here's the thing. People of every ethnicity are made in the image of God. So actually, there are going to be really gifted and anointed speakers of every color and every tribe and every tongue. You just got to do the work and find them. The on-ramps might not be the same, but actually, I mean, you look globally at the global church and you'll see massive, if your metrics are massive churches, you'll find them. Yeah. You'll find them very easily, in fact, bigger than the ones that are in the Western world. So it's not going to be hard to find. But if this is just I think the times when I wonder when it's tokenism is not what happens when I'm invited, it's what happens the year after.
What do you mean?
Well, because
did they learn from that?
Well, no, it's more, not so much whether they learned, but whether, is this an ongoing thing? Are you continually looking? Are you continually looking for women? Are you continually looking for people on the margins? Do you really consider that I'm on your margins? are you continually doing the work to find people from different spaces, different voices? Can someone who's in a wheelchair speak at your event? You know, are you continuing to push out, is this the topic of the year? And
sure,
because it's the
gotcha.
Topic of, and don't get me wrong, I think it's important to have current topics of the year. It's just that what's a topic of the year for you is my life.
That's right. People of color should not be one of them.
Yeah, this is not one of your topics of the year. Women aren't a topic of the year. Now, I do think we're in something of a moment with women right now, but actually not. You're half the sky. You're not a topic of the year. Yeah. I have a lot of conversations with leaders behind the scenes. Lots of recommendations. Lots of...
You recommending people, yeah. other people.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. I rarely... It's more often than I don't. It's rarer that I don't recommend than that I actually do. Because I this is partly my own theology in terms of mission and discipleship and all that kind of stuff. For me, the greatest thing is not just speaking at the event, but raising up the next person who will as well.
Yeah.
I think the church is weaker. I think the church is missing out when we don't hear the voices, and not exclusively on race, but on tithing and giving and money and discipleship and worship and all of these things. There is so much we could be learning and doing. There's so much creativity, there's so much gifting, there's so much opportunity when you hear it through different stories, and it so enriches your church, even when your church may be like majority white culture. It'll still enrich your community to hear the stories of everybody else, and so I love to recommend for that very reason. And it's important.
I suspect, and I wonder what you think about this, but I suspect that because so many white people who are putting on conferences and things, we think of our way of doing church is the standard way.
Or the normal way.
The normal way, the standard way, the regular way. And every other kind may have some legitimacy, but it's a variant on... the normal way.
The default norm.
Yeah, right. And so a lot of times the theology of, say, a black church is suspect to white people. I mean, half of these people, I think, could invite the black pastor from their own town to speak at the conference.
Yeah.
But because you've kind of entered into the white space and you're kind of like, okay, if you've been stamped as like, okay, she's one that us white people can trust, then we have to go there every time instead of trusting that black churches have the Holy Spirit too and have something to tell.
It's so fundamentally offensive even to think that that's in someone's mind, even as a blink thought. But I think there's the whole culture of popularity as well.
Sure. Yeah. There's a lot of intersectionality going on here.
Yeah. There's a lot of pieces. I think this is probably one of the bits that leaves me the most, not conflicted, but conflicted in And not in the sense of I feel, oh, should I feel this way? Just conflicted in terms of it's hard to know what to even do with some of that, which is the sense, the default to the norm. Because actually, and I remember this, and this wasn't when I was living here, but it was when I was living in the UK. There were like two or three conversions I had. I became a Christian and I met Jesus. And he transformed me and it was incredible. I was a kid. I'm not from a Christian background. My grandparents were Muslims. There are some people of faith in my family. There's a number of faiths represented in my family. And I met Jesus. That was my primary conversion. And then as I approached and I went to a Methodist church, which was wonderful. It was multi-ethnic. And not just multi-ethnic, in all the power structures. It was a little out of the box at that time. And it was wonderful. And I remember as I got into my 20s, there was another conversion to what was acceptable Christianity. Mm-hmm. And what was seen as a bit too much. There was a kind of another conversion to what my identity would be, whether I was too loud, whether I was too confrontational. And I thought, and I was hearing things for the first time. I was hearing that I wasn't hearing that I was too loud for the first time. I was hearing it connected to my spirituality for the first time. That's what it was actually happening. So in terms of, well, Christian women are like this, and Christian women should be like this, and the whole, do you have a gentle and meek spirit, and all of those things. And there was another conversion. There was a conversion to a style of music. Mm-hmm. Now, I love music, so I like it. But I grew up in R&B and hip-hop.
Yeah.
That was my genre. And Prince, because obviously it's Prince. And suddenly that was worldly music, but this was godly music. Yeah. And obviously there's gospel as well, but I'm into hip hop. And I'm into like old school now. Back then it was just the 80s. But and these things which were other, and my other, which was my norm, the food I ate, which was my norm, the values I had, which were my norm, were suddenly other norms to this Christian way of being. What was how you asked for things, how you approached things, how you asserted yourself. There was a lot of spirituality assigned to that. And so then there was the next conversion of, well, it, you know, because I've had the talk since I was seven, I know what I have to do if I want to get. It's not that you don't have to like me. I need to pay my bills.
Sure. Yeah. You know what
I mean? I need a job.
You got to get by in life.
I need a job. Do I? Sometimes even without thinking, and also with the kind of altruistic hope of, well, if I've always felt called to multi-ethnic context, so it's like, well, maybe if I'm here and if I engage with this my other world, if I put aside some of myself and my assumptions and my expectations and join another world, maybe we'll see a greater glimpse of heaven. You kind of need everybody to, you kind of need the power structures to dismantle that though.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? I didn't know that at 17, 18, 19. I just thought I was like, heaven's going to be diverse. So let's do all this together. I didn't know what I was kind of setting myself up for. And I didn't know what, I think that, to go to your point earlier where you said you see, you know, there are norms and people can sometimes assume that you are kind of with those norms. Those norms came at a cost. For any person of color you see in a white majority context, there's a cost. There's been a cost.
Yeah.
Because there of the conversion, it's not that you're not happy to be there. It's not that I don't love what I do, but there has been a cost.
Yeah.
There has been a cost that is so much part of the groove in which we live in that you don't even think about it all the time. Yeah. Until probably the last few years where it's like, hold the phone, everybody. This is ridiculous. But you just get on because, again, our faith is about sacrifice and all these other things. And then you're like, is anybody else sacrificing their style of music for this?
Yeah.
Anybody? Right. No? Right. Okay. Is anybody else thinking that just because we pray for longer, is that too long for you? Is that, no? Okay. Is anybody? And you suddenly realize that, or at least in my case, in my context, I realized that I had made a lot of little deaths.
Yeah.
And is anybody else? Now, I remember talking to one point about a website, and I said, you do know there's no people of color on this website. You know there's no women on this website, and it represents things that I'm part of, and I'm not the only woman here. Anybody? No? Okay, fine. And so I think there's just this ongoing challenge of of engaging what I called diversity, or what someone, well, actually not what someone else called diversity, was actually assimilation.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and I think too, I mean, it also hurts white people because it reaffirms the wrong thing in their head. Like, they might look at that and call it discipleship.
Oh, God.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, this person came in here and we buffed out the rough edges,
yeah,
which were, I mean, again, it goes back to, that's white supremacy, thinking that the white, yeah, culture is the correct way.
Yeah. I was very blessed in that when I came back, I had a bit of time out from the Lord because it was stressful. But when I came back to the Lord, one of the primary disciples for the first while was a black woman. Mm. And I'm very grateful, because I think then there was I think what I was so grateful for was the fact that in that relationship, I didn't have to convert being Nigerian. I didn't have to convert being a Londoner. I didn't have to convert being a woman. I didn't have to explain away the world in which the way God had designed me to be.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have to do that. I had this kind of sadly idyllic hub, and that. Now, that's not to say that every other disciple since didn't, and I've been very blessed by people who wouldn't assume they knew.
Yeah,
I remember talking to Mike Breen was my pastor at the time. Years ago, he asked, "How's someone doing?" And he asked, "How are you doing?" And I said, "Oh, well, you know." And he said, "No, I don't actually know what it's like to be a black young woman." And it was such a blessing to hear someone not assume they knew the answer to my story. Yeah. And I don't know. He said, "No, I actually don't know." So
you're gonna have to tell me.
You know, do you know what I mean? There was a kind of, and for the person in power, essentially the, yeah, person who was over it all, to acknowledge, There is something missing here because I don't have what you bring, mm-hmm, is a huge thing.
I want to shift the conversation a little bit. The last time we talked, you were on staff at your church pastoring.
Yes. But what year was that?
Boy.
I'm trying to work out which church it was.
It was Mission?
Oh, Mission Point, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
That you planted, right?
Yes.
Yeah. But you're not anymore.
Nope.
Do you still, is that still your church home?
It wasn't until very recently.
Okay.
Mm.
I wonder what was stepping down like for you. I know that you kind of had a runway to something else for a long time. I mean, people have been reading your books and inviting you to conferences. Yeah. And so was that a difficult transition or more natural?
I think it was quite natural on one level. I think it was natural because we trained up people who were doing a better job of it than we were.
Hey, that's the goal.
Do you know what I mean? And I think there comes a point where you just got to get out of the way. And there were a lot of circumstantial things. My husband was doing an MBA. I was being invited to speak at lots of things. That paid for certain things.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, Lord, I remember saying to God, I actually physically can't be there. And he's like, have you got it yet? And I said, and I tried, because I default to responsibility. I'm like, no, I'm just going to work harder. Then I'm like, Lord, I really can't be there. And he's like, I know. Do you know what I mean? And as heaven and the world waits for the penny to drop. I remember saying to the team, I need to step down. And I said, but you guys have been doing it anyway. And they're like, we know. And we know. And so to that end, it was lovely because, yeah, you know, you've invested in people and you've discipled people. And actually all that's left is for you to stop. All, yeah, that's left is for that person to really fly into all they're about. The only thing in the way is you. And so it's a privilege in that respect to be able to step away. And then you have the insecurities of your unknown and like, what's going to happen if I do this? And am I letting people down and all that? But actually, the whole point of discipling someone up into leadership is that they run ahead of you. And so when I was reminded of that was always the point, it was a fun thing to be able to do.
Was it, I know that we do this kind of with vocation in general, but I think especially with pastoring, we see ourselves as a pastor. And maybe that's a little bit of the gifting, but also the role. Was it hard to let go of that identity, or do you feel like you had to?
I felt like I had to. I think it's been harder. It's been harder in the light of the popular culture of the past few years. That's been way harder than Mission Point was a safe place. They were people who were friends, who were family. So even if there was something messy in me to let go of, they were the safest place to work it out. So that part of it wasn't hard. I think working out what it meant to represent the Lord well in a moment where it feels like, where so much feels like a dumpster fire.
Yeah.
That was harder. That was harder. Watching in some ways from the outside, because I'm an African Brit trying to work my way out in an American context, but I have two biracial kids growing up in this context. And actually, I'm not differentiating myself to seem separate, because actually I'm still a black woman walking the streets, and before they hear your accent and suddenly decide you're normal, which is not a blessing and not a compliment and really, really jacked. But before they hear your accent and suddenly you're acceptable, normal, accessible, you're a black woman. And neither of those options, do you know what I mean? The stereotype because on the account of your skin, or the, oh, you're English, so that makes you different, so that makes you safe. Neither of those are healthy.
Yeah.
So working all of that was probably made the other stuff easy. Letting go of being a pastor was fine compared to some of that. You know what I mean? I'm like, you know what? This is good. That out there, cray cray.
That's messed up.
That's what's messed up right now.
I want to get back to your book for a little bit, mm-hmm. The Dream of You. You know, there are, and I mean this in a genuinely complimentary way, there are a lot of books in the Christian space written by women, mostly for women, that are around these themes of not meeting the expectations of ourselves mm-hmm. and others, and then the shame that that can bring.
Yeah.
And I wonder, what is it about that, or what is it about our society today that makes that particularly or especially a problem for women?
Where to begin? I think what we're seeing, and even in the news with Me Too and marches, all highlights that in terms of what's a woman supposed to be. I remember reading this book called The Culture Code years ago, and Clotaire Apine, and he writes about basically how people buy stuff, marketing stuff. And he said, if I ever believed in reincarnation, I'd never want to come back as an American woman, although I admire them greatly. And he basically said they've got to be beautiful, but not too beautiful. Smart, but not too smart. They've got to have it down in business and some kind of creative venture, but they've got to have the perfect home. And then he ends with too many rules, too many tensions. And when I've shared that picture around, like when I'm speaking and stuff, there's always a loud amen to that one. And just from every age group, from every ethnic group. But when I'm in other countries, they'll say, not just American women.
Mm, they get it too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that's to live in a permanent state of too much and not enough. To live in the, you're free to do what you want, and the objectification you see in the magazines, and feeling compelled by those things and wanting to belong and wanting to assert who you are, wondering whether being assertive is actually aggressive, trying to explain to modify yourself so that you can get to where you need to be, because bills, because life, and because there are so many voices saying so many things all the time about what makes you worthy, what makes you valuable, what makes you acceptable, what makes you non-threatening, what makes you threatening, what makes you aggressive. I remember years ago, this was a few elections ago, 2008, and watching the news and people saying, is America ready for a female president? And I just thought, I'm like, that's a question? That, and I'm not even talking about the person concerned. And they actually weren't talking about it, but they were just talking about the principle. I'm like,
right.
So that's a question then.
Yeah.
And I think there are just so many things that just make it confusing. I'm not even saying good or bad at this point, just confusing.
Yeah.
And then add faith to that. And what have we spiritualized, which is just cultural?
Yeah.
And acceptable culture in this moment in time, in this chapter of history, in this part of the world, amongst these people. I'm not surprised people are confused, because there's so much. There's just so much junk. And it's not true. And it's not Jesus. And it's not clear. It's just not clear.
You know, I confess that I used to think of it, and this is looking back on it, like embarrassing to admit, but I used to think that it was a deficit in women. I mean, I used to think, come on, women, why don't you just be who you want to be and not care about what people think, which is like an incredibly white guy privileged thing to think about the situation. And obviously, it seems it's because a pressure, this is a cliched thing to say, but the pressure, the specific kind of pressure from society on women is what's producing the same outcome in all women. The shame inducing, the feeling like it's not enough or it's too much or whatever, yeah. Whatever
and,
it is.
And even if you don't believe it, you're still in its atmosphere.
What do you mean? Go on.
Like, I don't... So, for example, I'll give a particularly political example. So, a few weeks ago, you have a president who describes a number of nations as bleep hole countries.
Yeah.
One of them being the one where I'm from. I don't believe it. I know who I am.
Sure.
I know what I'm worth. It's like, you're not the first who said that, and you're not going to be the last. You don't move me. However, I have to deal with the fact that you've put that out there.
Yeah.
I have to deal with the fact that you've reinforced prejudice on ridiculous amounts of people.
Yeah.
But so even if it's not in me,
right.
Even if the storm's not in me, I'm in a storm.
Yeah.
And I think in the same way for, or in a, well, not necessarily in the same way, but I think sometimes amongst women, there is a thing of, sometimes there's a shame of, am I really doing this right? And sometimes I don't feel it, but I'm still in the midst of it. Yeah. I feel my body's good enough, but that's not going to stop the fact that these things are out there
yeah.
and that we all know they're airbrushed images, but we still buy the fantasy. We all know that that Pinterest is not a way to live your life, and we all love it for fun. And yet yeah. I love Instagram. I'm crazy about Instagram. But I know that, if I'm insecure about something, that those things mean more to me than they need to. So I think even when it doesn't hit you, I'm aware my kids grow up, my daughters grow up in an atmosphere, my peers, my siblings, all of us, because society is still people.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's still men and women who are getting on with life, doing their jobs, doing their thing, and, having expectations. And the hard thing is you don't always know the expectations that you have until they're messed with. And, yeah. And then you see stuff.
Yeah.
And then you see things. And I think for women, I mean, I understand your point in terms of saying, and I appreciate you saying it was a white male privilege thing to say, you know, come on, women, rise up. But there's a lot. To go back to some of the conference stuff, I mean, some of it is having to sit down and say, you do realize that these women are not going to put themselves forward.
Other women of color?
Or women, other women of color.
Or if it's not a women's conference, women in general.
Women in general.
Right. Yeah.
They're not going to put themselves forward. I remember a guy, good man saying to me once, if this woman wants to be discipled, he goes, I have guys who want to be discipled all the time. Why don't they just, they call me, they come to where I am. Why doesn't she come? And I said, because if a single woman comes to see you, you're going to be calling me saying, could you get her at my house? Aren't you?
Yeah, exactly.
And he paused and he said, yeah, that's a really good point. I said, you see, the on-ramp's not the same.
Yep.
She can't ask you, but you've assumed her distance is disinterest.
Yeah.
Or a lack of ability because the way you've raised people up, and I'm not saying it's bad to raise up your bros, but your sisters aren't going to meet you there. And there's a day, and that if that's the single story you're living by, it's incomplete.
Yeah.
It's incomplete.
Well, and what a great reason. Not that men can't disciple women and vice versa, but what a good reason to have women on your pastoral staff to be able to don't get me started. So the other thing I wanted to talk about was I have a friend of mine who recently took part in your cohort with women, and it was a retreat you had. I don't know.
Oh yeah, yeah. Called the Aza Collective. Yeah.
Yeah. So it seems like you have really made a conscious effort to invest in other women. You could do almost anything you want at this time in your career. And why taking a few women and mentoring them was something that you wanted to do with your time?
Mm-hmm. Oh, you got me started. Well, I think there are a number of reasons. One, I really believe that women can lead. I really do. But I also believe that they can lead in the light of what they believe God's calling them to. So I know that there are some of my good friends who would say we lead in the context of leading other women exclusively, and that's it. And others who are like, we can lead. I don't, just get equipped. I'm cool. I've got to trust that you can think. I don't have to think for you. Do you know, on that front. But I also, I think, you know, like sometimes you're aggravated by things, or at least maybe sometimes I'm aggravated by things. And I think I've been in these conversations, as we began with, at conferences where people say, where are the women? and I'm about to lose my mind. Or where are the women of color? About to lose my mind again, because I meet them in the bathrooms of those events crying. A number of the women who were at that gathering, I've met in the bathrooms of events in tears, saying, you're the first, you're the only, you're the different, saying, I don't know how to do this, and I feel I've got this call, but no one is prepared to invest in me, and no one is prepared to give, and they would be like, I get it. I get that I'm the only woman in their environment, but how am I ever going to learn? I get that it's complicated and we've not done this before, but and so they weren't even criticizing the, and fair, we all get the problem kind of thing, but, or the potential problem, but somebody at some point's got to do something. And I think for me, I was at that point of, recommending people and all that kind of stuff, but then thinking, okay, what does it look like? Here, there's this group of women around here who are saying, I need investment, and thinking, well, I can invest in you. I can invest in you, and I don't, and I can encourage you, and I can skill you, and to do whatever you feel God's calling you to do. Because I think there comes a point when this was, I'm trying to say this in a way that doesn't sound harsh, and I'm not sure I'm going to succeed, so we'll just go with it. When I'm not as interested anymore in having a place at somebody else's table.
Mm.
It's not that I don't love being, I mean, as you've seen, I've been at a lot of very interesting tables where you're like, how did you get there? They don't even believe in women speakers. Do you know what I mean? And I love it, but you're always a guest at somebody else's table. And I'm, you know, I'm a Nigerian and I'm a Brit. We do manners and we do respect. So I'll always serve an event. I'll always, but I can also build my own tables. And if you build your own table, you get to decide other things. And I just thought, what would it look like to be able to build a table, or build a house, frankly, where people could come and discover what they're about and then just see. And I don't care whether it's in the context of their neighbors next door or if it's in the context of planting multiple churches, like you see with loads of church planting women in India and China. I don't mind what it is, but you'll never know unless you're invested in.
Mm.
And so I wanted to give women a space. And also because I've seen... how often women can edit their callings in the presence of guys, even if they know those guys are for them.
No, that's fascinating.
Even if they know the guys are for them, they'll start saying, I don't know, when they know the answer.
Hmm.
Or they'll start shrinking a little bit because their expectation is, I come behind you, I hide for you, or I work hard enough and don't articulate what I'm about, hopefully, because if I overwork for you, then you'll notice I'm really gifted.
Yeah.
Rather than say, I'm called. So I wanted to have a kind of training vehicle in some way. And I thought, what are all the best things I've encountered along the way? And what have been the costly things I've encountered? And how can we kind of shape that into something that will train and develop women and remind them that not alone? And I tell you, we had 2 days together. And you kind of do a kind of, how's your day and what's God done with you today? And I was struck by two particular things. One woman stood up and said, just hearing everybody introduce themselves was really powerful for me to say, as this woman said, and I'm a pastor, I'm the director of this NGO, I'm a CFO at this company, because there were women who were in business, women who are NGO leaders and ministry leaders as well. And she said, I'm not alone. They've always been the unicorn. Do you know what I mean? They've always been the unusual one. And now there are 70 women who are just like them, leading like they are. Another one said that she was really blessed to see women of color as leaders. Because she said, I don't even know how to say this, but I don't often get to encounter women of color who are leading the event, who are defining the culture and all of that kind of stuff, rather than the person who I'm serving to help in some particular way. It just feels really important. It feels, who was it? William Booth, who said, some of my best men are women. And I just, on a missional level, on a level of being a sent people to engage the world around us, you are shooting yourself in the foot when you only utilize half of the people. I mean, and I think we utilize less than half because we rely on particular structures and positions rather than a priesthood. And for me, most of the ministry I've done has been leading men and leading in the context of men primarily. But for me, it feels like this is the next leadership thing I've got to do. I need to engage and center women and invest in women of color. And I was struck by the fact that women in their 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, and I think 60s there. And I just thought, how many people are we missing out? What are we not doing? And I'll give you one last thing. Otherwise I'll ramble about this forever. I remember asking the women, we were talking about fears and how fear limits us. And I asked this a lot. I said, how many of you, you're doing stuff, but you're not doing what you really want to do. You're doing what you can get away with.
Yeah.
And 80% put their hand up. I asked the question again, 90% put their hand up. Happens every time I ask that question. And then I said, we need to think of what's not happening. What are the NGOs that aren't started? What are the businesses? What are the churches or the church initiative, the parachurch ministries that aren't happening because we've hidden all of this stuff? What captives aren't being freed? And I'm not saying it's a guilt thing. I'm just reminding us of what is possible when we invest and empower people to live and lead into their full God-given potential. I said, that's what's at stake here. There are always going to be people who tell you you can't lead. Always. There are always going to be people who, and also they're members of your family. You know what I mean? They are members of the body of Christ who you love, and they're people who you love in the Lord, but they have a different theological landscape.
Yeah.
They're always going to be there. And there are always going to be people who are going to assume because you're a woman of color that you can't do stuff, which is dumb and actually racist, but that's your problems are your problems. They're actually not my problem.
Yeah.
Because I'm not going to stand before you. I'm going to stand before the Father, and he's going to say, and again, I don't even mean it as a guilt thing. I'm just like, I want to be responsible with what I've got. If he's given me 10 talents, I want to use them. If he's given me two, I want to use them. Yeah. I don't want to bury him because someone doesn't like me. I mean, I did that in high school. It never ended well. You know what I mean? When you stopped doing stuff because people didn't like you.
Yeah.
When you stopped being yourself and you tried to be someone else because that was, everybody was into Wham that day. Actually, that wasn't the one because everybody was into Wham. And so they should because they're awesome. But because everybody was into something else that day. And I thought, I'm not on the playground anymore. I'm a grown woman. And I've got a calling and I've got gifts and I've got abilities. And when I looked across the room, so did they.
Yeah.
And what a price we pay when we don't invest in them to realize what they could do.
Yeah. I mean, I was glad to hear you say that most of the leadership you've done is leadership of men, because I find that all of this is somewhat of a catch-22 for me, because, and I kind of went off on Twitter the other day on this, you know, I'm very familiar with the Christian publishing world because of this podcast. Mm. And it seems like so often men write books for everyone and women write books for other women. And that's such a catch-22 because there are women like you who are saying, I want to invest in these women so that they can be these leaders and go lead. And yet, you know, I think God's upside down kingdom looks like white guys sitting at the feet and learning from women of color. And it's frustrating sometimes when women are only writing to other women. Mm. You know what I mean? And I think that's primarily a publishing problem because they're trying to market.
Yeah. It's funny. It's a weird world as well, isn't it? Because on one level, I remember talking about this with the 3DM guys and someone said, is it for women? And I said, I write about women and I address women. And so women are centered in the book, but you can read it. And I remember one of the guys saying, you know, to be honest, we've been expecting women to do that for years. Do you know what I mean? We've been telling, I remember him saying, he goes in the same way. And they actually, that's what they all say. They all say now that they're like, actually in the same way that we have assumed things about our books and they've been male focused and male characters and all this kind of stuff. And women have read them. He goes, well, now it's our turn. We'll just do that. And it's funny, like even with the podcast that Steph and I lead, someone asked us if it's a women's podcast. And we're like, no, it's a leadership podcast.
Yeah.
But two women lead it.
Yeah.
But it's a leadership podcast. And inevitably, there'll be a lot of women who listen in, partly because there haven't been many opportunities otherwise.
Yeah.
And so some of it is the women will rush in numbers because they're like, finally.
They're thirsty for
that. They're thirsty for living, visible, tangible examples. This quote I overuse, but I love it so much, I'm going to do it again, where Marion Wright Edelman says, you can't be what you can't see, or it's hard to be what you can't see.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's like, when you see someone else do it, and they don't even have to be doing it well all the time, or they don't even have to be doing it exactly like you, but it's like, okay, I've seen a woman there.
Yeah,
okay.
You know it's possible then.
Yeah, you know it's possible. And it's not that it's impossible to do that without it, but it's very hard. Really, really hard. It's tiring.
Well, Joe, it's been so good talking with you. I'm so glad we, one, that we finally got to meet in person.
Yay!
And just for taking the time. I know your schedule's really busy this weekend.
Thanks for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Remember, you can find all the show notes for this show and all shows at shaneblackshear.com. Oh, and hey, have you ever thought about starting your very own podcast? I bet you have. And I think you should do it. In fact, I've created a course just for you to teach you everything that I've learned over the last couple of years producing Seminary Dropout. So if you're interested in podcasting and want to learn how, go check out my course. You can go there by typing in podcastingforeveryone.org. And you can get a special discount by typing in the discount code SeminaryDropout, all one word. That'll give you 25% off. So go check it out. If you have any questions, let me know. Okay. Thanks to those that left ratings and reviews on iTunes this week. Remember, that keeps the show front and center. Also, remember, you can find me on Twitter at @beardonabike. That's @beardonabike. Also, I'm on Facebook, facebook.com/ShaneBlackshear123. And remember that Seminary Dropout is listener supported. You can visit supportseminarydropout.com and press become a patron. Remember, this music you're listening to right now is by D.L. Rossi. You can find him online on iTunes and at dlrossi.com. All right, thanks again for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Stay tuned for next week's episode. Love you. Take care. Yeah, that's my best.